Okay, so he's talking the world economic crisis and rebellion, an update. Now, I guess everyone here is pretty familiar with the broad terrain of the economic crisis when it hit the global economy in late 2008, sparked off by the global financial crisis in Wall Street, the meltdown of a series of banks, and a cataclysmic decline in investment, trade, and GDP across the Western world. So where the update is basically to tell you that there's been a degree of stabilization then of the world economy this is basically graphs giving an indicator of industrial output and services output across the major economies of the world system. The United States on the top left, UK top right, Euro area at the bottom left, and China on the bottom right. And basically what you can see without going into too much detail is how industry and services output sank in the course of 2008-2009. Everything below this horizontal dark line indicates decline, everything above the line indicates an increase. So you can see for the best period of maybe 12 months or so that manufacturing and non-manufacturing industries were in decline across both the Western world and also for that matter in China. Now, since that time, the stimulus packages that were introduced in the course of early 2009 created something of a bounce back in world trade and industry. And so you can see this bounce back here, the rate of decline stops increasing, and then you begin to see an actual increase in the absolute amount of industrial and services output across most of the world economies. Next one, Ben. And you can also see this in terms of trade. This is global trade. And again, everything below the line 50 is a contraction, everything above the line 50 is an expansion. And you can see the fact the catastrophic decline in world trade in the course of 2008 and 2009, followed by a bit of a bounce back in 2010. So, stabilization as well. Ben, next one. You can also see something of stabilization in the jobs market as well. This is American unemployment and Euro unemployment and Japanese unemployment. You might not be able to see this line down here. This is Japanese unemployment, this is US unemployment, and this is Euro area unemployment. And again, you can see as the world economic crisis kicks in 2008-2009, there's a sharp increase in unemployment in all three areas, and there's something of a stabilisation in all three. And if the figures to be believed in the United States, something of a decline in the last year, although a lot of that is simply a statistical aberration about the fact a lot of people have given up looking for jobs and no longer count as unemployed, according to the statistician's crazy definition of these things. However, this recovery has been uneven. It's been uneven by country, by region. Generally speaking, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, have done rather better than the Western countries. And it's been uneven, of course, most importantly, by class. That the rich have basically prospered out of this recovery and the working class have gotten relatively little. Next slide. Oh, sorry, it's done already, sorry. This gives you an indicator of the jobs market in America. And this line up here is basically level pegging, and everywhere below the line is a contraction in jobs. And the dark line here is a contraction in jobs in the most recent recession in America. So you can see, if you had very fine tuned glasses, you can see how the fact that the jobs market took out 6% of all jobs in the course of the economic crisis of 2008-2009 died. And compared to previous recessions in the post-war years, which are all these kind of different coloured lines up here, you can see how sharp the recession was this time around compared to previous recessions. Since about middle of or early 2010, you can begin to see it flattening out. But look, really, we're still in a situation where, despite this recovery, there are 5.5% fewer jobs now than there were 3 years ago. So a recovery for the bosses, whose profits have soared, and whose bank bonuses have gone back to the roof again, but not so much for the working class. One more slide, Ben. This one here just tells you about how long people have been unemployed on average in the United States. And you can see here, this takes you all the way from 2001 to 2011, now, for a period of time, most people lost their jobs, were unemployed on average for about 17 weeks, about 4 months. And then, with the economic crisis, here's a recovery, by the way, you can see how long people are unemployed. About 40 weeks or about 10 months now. The average duration of unemployment in the United States is about 10 months. So you can see how in this recovery, the working class have been doing it hard. that, by contrast, profits are back up through the roof again. That's where you can blank it now. I think it's the end of it. All right. So, despite the fact then the world economy has, if like stabilised, you might say, for a period of time under the impact of the stimulus packages, partly due to the continuing growth of China, however, this has not led to any relaxation of the pressure on the working class. Not just in relation to unemployment, but also, and this will be the major theme of this talk, in terms of budgets as well. Because precisely because the ruling class spend trillions of dollars in bank guarantees, in stimulus packages, and also because they lost a lot of money in terms of the recession itself always has a drag effect on the budget. With a recession, fewer people are in work, and therefore greater social security spending has to be outlaid, no matter how mean and miserly unemployment benefits might be. And also, with fewer people in jobs, people buying goods in department stores, then there's less tax revenue being taken in by the government. So all these factors combined came to create a big surge in budget deficits around the world. That is the difference between what governments spend and what governments take in the form of tax revenue. And equivalent to GDP, national output, budget deficits surged by about 5% of GDP. So in Australian terms, if we were to say that Australian GDP is around about $1.2 trillion, 5% of $1.2 trillion, a lot of money. What would that be? Would it be $50 billion, I believe, about $60 billion? And that's the equivalent of how much budget deficit has gone up, if you like, multiply that across the world in every major government, China included. So the kind of political reality over the last 18 months or so has been governments have been going on the attack in order to try to wind back these budget deficits. And so this is the context for the kind of talks we've been hearing this evening and this weekend so far from Sean Harkin talking about the United States, from Joe Carolan talking about Ireland, from Panassos Kokoulas talking about Greece, and I'm going to be talking about each of these episodes. This is the broad context. The governments are saying, we're facing a debt crisis now, we have to slash spending, we have to raise taxes. Those days of reflationary stimulus packages, they're all gone. Now, this is particularly the case in the weaker European states, where essentially the financial piranhas of companies, the banks, the great banks who themselves receive billions of dollars in bailouts and bank government guarantees, have basically decided to attack the government revenue-raising capacity of the so-called PIGs, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. Basically, they're making a bet. They're making a bet that at some point these governments will not be able to repay their loans. And so they're attacking their currencies and forcing up the interest rates, they're forcing up the interest rates on the debts that governments have to incur in order to borrow. So like just think of a little household. If you're a particularly impoverished working class household that goes to the bank will probably charge you a higher rate of interest than even Mr. Orban's money bags that goes to the bank with the bank as key to get your custom. Well, the governments of Portugal, Ireland, Greece and Spain, if you like the POBO governments that go to the world bond markets and say, look, we'd like to issue debt, issue bonds, in other words, to raise money for the world's financial markets, and to find out what the world's investors, i.e. speculators, are demanding that these governments pay in a rate of interest on the debts they take out. And whereas the average debt to interest on bond markets worldwide for most Western governments is about 4%, in the case of the PIGs, the speculators have been driving up interest rates to anything between 9 and 12%. Now, it's a bit like you, if you've got a MasterCard debt and you're paying 30% interest rates on it, pretty soon you'll find you have to run faster and faster simply in order to stop going backwards. Well, in terms of government bond markets, the same kind of process has been underway in the PIGs. There comes a point when to raise government loans on world bond markets, having to pay 9 or 12%, essentially it's a one-way road to bankruptcy. So in this situation, what governments have had to do is to raise money somehow. And this is a point of crisis for the world's financial markets, because even though on the one hand the banks and investors are speculating on the outcome of a crunch or a crash in these currencies in these countries, on the other hand, the banks in Europe and in North America are acutely aware that the existing stock of debt they hold in these government bonds are issued by Portugal, issued by Greece, issued by Ireland, and they're worried that unless these governments can get access to funds somehow, they're going to default. They refused to pay back their past debts and wipe them out. In other words, all those German banks holding bonds and the issued by the Irish government or issued by the Greek government, and we're talking about $2.5 trillion of bonds are held by European and American banks in the pigs' governments. Essentially, if all the pigs' governments said tomorrow, fuck you, we're not going to pay our debts back and throw all the bonds, the invoices or receipts or whatever in the big bonfire, the European and American banks would lose $2.5 trillion. Now, it's no secret to say that the fortunes of a lot of banks in Europe and North America are pretty shaky even now as it is. So imagine if all of a sudden, all those credits, if you like, they got in their balance book saying, we hold, you know, $100 billion in bonds from the Irish government, they're now going to put a big cross through that saying, well, actually, they're worth nothing now. And so you can see how that's going to have a huge drag effect on their balance books. No longer will they be able to claim those as credits, and therefore their own finances will be pushed downwards, risking another financial collapse. So the outcome of all this has been the European Union, the IMF, have ridden in on a white horse to save the fortunes of the European banks. They've issued bailout packages. Now, when you think about bailouts, you might think about people coming to rescue or help somebody else. Well, they have come to rescue or help somebody else, but it's not the ostensible type of the bailout. You kind of think, oh, they're bailing out the Italian government, they're bailing out the Irish government, in that case, the Greek government, then the Irish government. It makes you think like these, you know, the IMF and the European Union are giving money to these people to help them out. That's very far from the reality. The reality is that the IMF and the European Union have been lending the governments money simply in order they can repay the past debts they've accumulated, which are held by the German banks, by the French banks, by the British banks, by the American banks, to stop them going bankrupt. So if you like, it's a kind of a financial transfer mechanism going on, which sort of starts with the German government into the German banks. And in the meantime, the Greek government and the Irish government, who are supposedly the beneficiaries of these bailouts, are simply a kind of conduit for this money. They sort of start with the German working class taxpayers having to pay more tax, or having to see their government services slashed, in order to finance the bailout packages, the European Union passes it down to the Greek government. The Greek government can then use to pay back the debts, which is incurred 3 years ago or 5 years ago for the German banks. So it's like another form of cross-subsidisation from working class taxpayers to the banking system. So we thought we might have seen the end of this perhaps at the beginning of 2009 when bank bailouts seemed to stabilise things, but actually this is what these stimulus packages constitute. So this is a complete raid on the fortunes and finances of the European working class. And of course, like when you go to the bank and you're desperately in debt, and the bank says, okay, we're willing to extend our loan to you, but we're going to push up the rate of interest, and we're going to insist you sell your car, and we're going to insist you, downsize to a smaller house, and whatever, so you have a better capacity to pay back your debts to us. That's what the European Union and IMF have now been doing to all these pigs' governments. The loans they've been extending from in the form of bailout packages, they're saying, okay, what you need to do is to undertake austerity measures. And I guess most people in this room now are fairly familiar with the details of austerity measures, because you've heard a series of talks by comrades internationally outlining what they are. Of course, we're talking about cuts to pensions, cuts to social security, extending pension ages, cuts to public services, cuts to health services, cuts to public service jobs, and, you know, things that can't possibly be justified on any kind of financial basis. Like, you know, ripping up the trade union protection, undermining minimum wage. What the bloody hell is that going to do with repaying debt? It doesn't raise any money, if you like, for the German government, but for the Greek government or the Irish government. Clearly what we can see is that this debt crisis is in some ways purely a cover for undertaking large-scale attacks against the working class of these countries. So the governments themselves are using the panic about the debt in order to create a sense of national emergency, a financial shock and awe, which they can unleash by heavy bombardment, a la, you know, the neocons attack in Iraq in 2003, to use their financial cruise missiles, their financial B-2 bombers, to obliterate working class living standards in Athens, in Dublin, in Lisbon, and so forth. Now, the outcome of this, even before these packages in the EU, IMF austerity programs, like the Portuguese government is now in its fourth austerity budget, which is the one that's just been knocked back. The Irish government, even before the bailouts in December last year, had already undertaken three or four constant rounds of belt tightening. So these governments have already, in order to try and hold off the speculators, in order to be able to try and stabilise their financial situation, have already been undertaking, you know, a year and a half of constant anorexic belt tightening. So they're getting thinner and thinner. Unfortunately, of course, some people's belts have been tightened, but not others. Generally speaking, the people who had most capacity to give have been given more, and the people who have had the least capacity to give, from whom more has been taken. And so this is very much an extension of, like, a one-sided class war that's been going on over a series of decades now. So we know about the situation, I'm hoping, in Ireland. Joe Carolan spoke in this very room last night very movingly about the situation in Ireland, what it's meant for his family. They've lost their jobs, they've seen their pay cut by 50%. You know, we've heard the situation of mass unemployment. Even before these austerity measures came in, Spain has not yet had an IMF EU rescue package. Unemployment's already 20% there. In Ireland, unemployment's gone up from 4% under the Celtic Tiger days to 15%. In Portugal, youth unemployment is 35%. That's what the government measures. In Spain, youth unemployment is probably 40 or 50%. So there's a whole generation of working class people and fresh university graduates in the southern European countries and in Ireland who basically never see a steady job. Now, the problem with this, just even from the perspective of straightforward mainstream economics, is actually this is nothing to solve the crisis. Because what you're doing is kind of belt-tightening already thin people and expecting to work harder. Well, you can't work harder on shorter rations. You need a certain amount of energy, a certain amount of fusion to the system to keep you going. So economically what's happening is a withdrawal from all the spending power, the cuts in pensions, the cuts in student allowances, the cuts in jobs, is sucking out spending power from these economies and suddenly expecting them to surge forward. It's like an athlete on the eve of the Olympic Games, saying, right, you're not going to eat anything for the next 3 days and expecting them to run the 400 or 10,000 metres in record time. They're not going to be able to do it. They're going to fall over. And that's basically what's happening with these economies. Sucking spending power out of them is actually having a reverse effect to what those inflationary stimulus packages had back in 2009. And so we're seeing in Greece, GDP down by 6% just in the course of the last year. And this process is happening in a widespread way. And also, this is doing nothing actually to really solve the debt crisis either. But you think about it, Thanasis has spoken on this in the sessions he's given. Basically what you're saying is that the problem is that government debt as a proportion of GDP is too high, 125% in the case of Greece. Now what we're going to do is slash GDP by austerity measures, we're going to reduce your tax raising capacity, we're going to throw more people on the dole, and we expect that debt to GDP ratio to sink. But of course, as you can see, you apply basic arithmetic, if GDP is sinking, then the ratio is going to start rising. Because, you know, you've got more and more debt now on which interest is being charged at 5 or 6% when your revenue raising capacity through people being in work and able to spend and pay income tax is being reduced, and therefore the actual debt burden gets higher and higher and higher. And that's why many mainstream economists are saying, actually, the sensible thing to do for Greek government is to default partly on something's debt. Now, the Greek government at the moment is saying, no way, we're not going to do that. Because they're worried that if they do that, they'll lose all their credibility on international markets. But I think you have to say, it's probably only a matter of time before the Greek government goes, essentially cap in hand, to the German banks and the British banks and says, okay, sorry, we can't pay up all of it. Now, what happens then, when the German government and the British government and the American government say, okay, maybe we better oversee a rescheduling of debt, well, the banks aren't going to be very happy in Germany, Britain, and America, because they're now not going to get all the money back they thought they were. And so that's the great fear that hangs over all this, which is that these governments are basically going to spark off, finding the solution of big peak debts, another round of financial crisis. So that's a whole kind of game that's going on at the moment between them. And it's a lose-lose scenario for the working class. Now, the other thing is that the debt elsewhere, it keeps probably about 15, 20 and so forth. The other thing is that the debt elsewhere is much more of a mirage. Because if you look at countries like America, if you look at Germany, you look at France, you look at Britain, you look at Italy, actually, their debt is not far off what peak debt is. In the case actually of Italy, it's as high as Greece. In the case of America, Britain, Germany, France, the peak of the debt in ratio to GDP is about 80 to 100%. That's an enormous amount of money. But Generally speaking, these governments have, these countries have been subject to big speculative attacks. Why? Because the financial nodes expect these countries to be able to deliver and to pay back their debts. They reckon they have a secure credit rating and all these other things that, you know, the Moody's and Standard & Poor's go on about. They're thought to be strong, powerful governments with the ability to trade their way out of debt. So at some level, they have been subject to the same pressures as the Irelands, as the Greeces, as the Portugals, and so forth. But nonetheless, that hasn't stopped these governments from using this debt crisis as a lever to press down working class living standards in these countries. They've essentially sounded the alarm, unsustainable debt. You open up an American newspaper these days and you can't escape articles about the unsustainable, entitlement spending. Entitlement spending is luxuries and fripperies like medical care for elderly people, or, you know, food stamps programs, or this sort of thing. So this sort of thing has to go. And right now, there's a debate in the American ruling class, basically, about whether or not they should cut $4 trillion in the next 10 years, or $6 trillion in the next 10 years. This is a time when they can spend, outlay every year, $708 billion on arms expenditure, and that doesn't include what they actually spend on the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. In a kind of way of these things, you're actually talking about more like $1.5 trillion every year on the American military project. So enormous amounts of money being spent. If you raise the rate of tax on the American rich to where it was just 30 years ago, you can wipe out the debt overnight. So in essence, this debt crisis is actually a better phrase as being a failure of the rich to pay the tax crisis. And that's really what we're seeing. The rich pay tax at the rate they did 30 years ago, the debt crisis will be wiped out overnight. If America basically cancelled its whole ratcheting up of defence spending, military spending that's engaged in the last 10 years, then the debt would be wiped out. But of course, funnily enough, the American imperialists, the American capitalist class, aren't that interested in winding back military spending, and they're not that interested in paying tax on their third or the fourth home, or their penthouse in Manhattan. So they are ensuring that the whole burden of adjustment is forced onto the shoulders of the working class. And so we've seen America, I've already mentioned the fact, debates about how many trillions to cut, an Obama change, we can believe in, yes we can, as riding forth, sallying into the debate, promising a progressive cut of only $4 trillion, whereas those dastardly right-wing head cases in the Republicans are promising cuts of $6 trillion. So take your poison. In Britain, we saw a budget late last year, £81 billion being taken out of spending on the British economy. This is the biggest cut in government spending relative to GDP since 1921, which has gone down in history as a horror budget to end all horror budgets. And so we're seeing cuts across the board in Britain, in the United States, where a whole series of basic programs that people fought for and won back in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, when the world economy was in a boom, they're now being taken away from them year after year. And a whole program of marketization, privatization, selling off government businesses, allowing the Bupas of the world, the private health plans, the private contractors to cherry-pick the National Health Service in Britain, to sell off a whole series of facilities like libraries, health clinics, and basic frontline services, shut down fire stations, to close off unemployment benefits. And just like in Southern Europe, of course, this is having a disastrous impact on GDP, on national output. Britain, which is engaging in its program of austerity, it's got forecast to have growth this year of a massive 1.7%. This is a kind of, to call this as a recovery is something of a stretch of definitions. Having seen a crisis this deep, normally you'd expect to see a fairly sharp bounce back with GDP going up by 5 or 10% a year. Well, 1.7% is not going to cut it in terms of sustaining a recovery. Now, of course, there are a series of other underlying problems in the world economy as well. I don't have time to go through. There is the fact that banking crisis, most of the problems in the banking system that were supposedly solved in 2009 have simply been swept under the carpet. There's the fact that the imbalances in the world economy between China and Germany on the one hand, and the United States in the other, are still fraught with tension and potentially capable of leading to currency wars, a fresh round of protectionism, and so forth. And finally, there's the fact that drastic though the crisis was, it didn't wipe out the amount of capital stock that would be required through things like closures, bankruptcies, mergers. It didn't wipe out sufficient capital stock to restore the world economy to a sustained recovery. That there's a whole series of debt still hanging on the system, a whole series of excess capacity with idle factories, idle machinery and capital equipment, of companies operating on 70% capacity, which are still in operation, being propped up by the state oftentimes. Now, as we've heard, of course, the other really fantastic element of this situation has been the resistance to it. Because if it's at the end of the talk there, we could all go away and feel fairly miserable. But of course, the working class has never just been a passive victim of capitalist machinations. The working class knows the story in many countries. It can see what it's already faced in the form of austerity and the years of pain that lie ahead of it. And so we've seen already, even before this year, a whole series of general strikes in France, in Italy, in Spain, in Greece. There seems to be something of a kind of a, what would you call it, an auction going on or whatever, or bidding process of how many general strikes Greece has actually had. I wrote that it had 7 last year, but for NASA says there'd be 8 last year. So we've seen a whole series of resistance movements in Europe. This year, we've seen both the 9th and the 10th general strike in Greece. We've seen a whole series of core industries being brought to a halt by workers' action, by occupations of workplaces, by a no-pay movement in Greece where people are simply refusing to pay public private road tolls, where, you know, we hear the story from Thanasis about a village of 5,000 people rising up against toxic waste dumping imposed on their area, and so forth. Portugal. We've seen roads being blockaded by truck drivers, demanding a freeze in fuel prices. Teachers, transport workers, postal workers all went on strike in March. A Facebook group, speaking about Facebook, supposedly causing the Arab Revolution. Well, Facebook can be a facilitator, I guess you say, rather than kind of a generator. A group of people on Facebook, calling themselves the Desolate Generation, called for a rally in Lisbon, Portugal, against austerity measures in March. 200,000 people marched in this protest. Another 80,000 in Portugal's second city, Porto. And so this is illustrative of the kind of both the despair and also the anger that exists in many of these countries. In Belgrade, in Serbia, not normally a city you associate with struggle, we've seen protests of 10 or 20,000 teachers, doctors and public sector workers, and a wave of student occupations in Italy, Austria and Greece late last year. Now, again, if I finish the talk there, you might think, well, things are pretty dreadful, those Europeans, goodness, they can fight. But what about those kind of Anglo-Saxon countries like Britain or America, because they're, you know, totally, you know, flat and anemic in terms of their form of struggle. But of course, as we've seen in the last 6 months, that story's been changed as well. In the case of Britain, we saw 4 days of student demonstrations in November and December, which were the biggest wave of student protests since 1968. And we also saw, just the 26th of March, not 3 or 4 weeks ago, 500,000 people, workers, pensioners, students and so forth, protesting the streets of London against the Tory government's budget cuts. And so, in both Britain, in Britain, we've seen the beginnings of a revival of class struggle. And this has created something of a shift in public sentiment, a widespread hostility to what the government's doing, and a support for protest when it occurs. And there's now talk about a general strike in the public sector taking place in May. In America, we've seen this extended war going on against the working class for decades, and the American working class has basically been beaten back without much of a fight. Well, in Wisconsin, they finally put their foot down. And as the American Socialist Worker newspaper put it, the sleeping giant has awoken and begun to get to its feet. Like, I won't go through all the details about the Wisconsin protests. I've kind of run out of time, essentially. I'm hoping some of you have heard the story from Sean Harkin on Thursday night. Those of you who haven't, I can always elaborate on it privately after this discussion, if you like. But essentially, up to 100,000 people protested in the state capital, Madison, and Thousands occupied the state parliamentary building for 2.5 weeks to try and prevent the Republican governor bringing in a business austerity budget and union bashing legislation. Now, governments are also feeling the heat electorally. Joe Carroll spoke last night about the defeat suffered by the Fianna Fáil government in Ireland. Fianna Fáil has basically run the Irish government for the last 90 years. And it was smashed to bits. Its parliamentary representation falling drastically. Its Green Party coalition party being eliminated altogether. That was just an indicator of, as one right-wing commentator actually put it, the rise of the ballot box. In Portugal, we've seen the government fall after many years in office because all the opposition parties, both left and right, refused to pass its fourth austerity budget. And Portugal basically now no longer has a government. In Greece, PASOK did fairly badly at the regional elections last November. And in France, Sarkozy is in deep trouble with his campaign for re-election in 2012. Okay. Now, having said all that, sorry, I'm just lost my page here. Just give me a moment. 1890, I'm sorry. I think we're looking at page 16 and page 17. Here we go. Now, the story doesn't end there, though, because I simply talked about, okay, government attacks, working class resistance, you know, the battle is kind of even Stevens. I think you have to say at the moment, even though there's been this wave of resistance, there are also some limitations. You have to draw some of a balanced assessment about where we are. The first limitation to understand is the fact that even though there have been these great waves of struggle, the dead weight of the past still hangs over the consciousness and the organisation of the living, to paraphrase Marx. The American International Socialist said in Wisconsin, they said the sleeping giant is getting to his feet, or her feet, but is still groggy. That is still staggering, stumbling a bit, and trying to land punches that don't hit the target. So they rose up in the course of Wisconsin, but still the dead weight of defeatism, the dead weight of you can't fight, you have to accept budget cuts, you have to accept government attacks, you can't go too far, you shouldn't rely on strikes, alienate public opinion, wait for the next elections, trust the Democrats or the Labour Party. All this kind of politics still hangs over and permeates the leadership of these struggles, which even though they can throw up new generations of young people in the course of the struggle, nonetheless established institutions of the Labour movement, which in Britain is the Labour Party and the Trade Union Congress, in the case of America is the Democrats and the AFL-CIO, they're basically scared of these movements. They essentially accept 80% of what the government's saying. We have lived beyond our means, we do need to tighten our belts, we do need to accept cuts, but just not this harsh or this quick. And so they're saying, look, let's find a more realistic way out of this crisis. And a more realistic way of this crisis means, well, maybe we should cut there instead of there, or maybe we should cut 2013 instead of 2011. But they don't challenge the basis of the whole program, saying the debt crisis is a fraud. And insofar as there is a crisis, let the rich pay and cut military spending. They don't put up that kind of program. So this kind of thing weighs on the struggles. And it means that, for example, in Wisconsin, the whole occupation of the Capitol building was diverted into an essentially vote Democrat campaign at the forthcoming Senate election to bring those Senate elections forward, to try and stack the Wisconsin Senate with Democrats, and hope to God they'll reverse these attacks. In Britain, even though the March for the Alternative, the March of 500,000 workers, was a fantastic display of working class resistance, when Ed Miliband, the Labour Party leader, appeared at the podium, he said, well, frankly, we have to accept some cuts. And the TUC, their approach is rather like the ACTU in Australia in relation to work choices, which is that electoralism is the answer. Okay, we don't love the government, we have to wait for Labour or the Democrats or whatever to take office. And so the TUC's main focus right now is on the 5th of May local council elections. Now this is pretty stuff. Number one, the local councils don't determine the national budget. Number two, the local councils, the Labour local councils, have already passed savage cuts in local government services under the impact of central government cuts. So there is actually no indicator. And number three, the next central government elections don't have to happen until 2015. Such is democracy in the number of parliaments. They only have their elections every 5 years there. So this whole idea of, well, let's channel the resistance towards an electoral outcome is a total dead end. The second point to make out is that the student struggle, such as we've seen in many European countries, can be very volatile. And the British experience is a very good indicator of that. That we saw, as if out of nowhere, 4 days of action through November and December, involving fighting in the streets and terrorising of royal cars and a variety of other shock outrages. That, as far as I can tell, I didn't do a detailed search for this, but I've heard nothing, someone can correct me if I'm wrong, there'd be no repetition of this in the spring term that we've just basically come to the end of in Britain. There haven't been anything like an extension of the occupations and demonstrations that we saw back in November and December. And this is not surprising, because student movements tend to go like that. They go boom, out of nowhere, or with almost no prior warning, and all of a sudden, you've got these campuses where there's been no activity for 30 years, suddenly they're occupying at, University Chancery, and then a week or 2 weeks later, flat as a pack. Well, this seems to have happened basically in Britain, and this is quite consistent with the pattern of student struggle. That unless they're sustained by some broader wave of struggle involving trade unions, the student struggle tends to subside fairly quickly. Now, the final limitation on the wave of struggle so far has been that there have been some left-wing beneficiaries of this process. There have been some political shift to the left in some episodes. So, for example, Joe Carolan from Ireland has told us about the fact that 5 TDs, MPs, from the United Left Alliance have been elected to the Irish Parliament. In Portugal, the Portuguese left bloc has done quite well in elections. In the case of Greece, the Greek Communist Party has also seen a surge in its vote. But, despite those so-called signs, you have to say the main beneficiaries of the economic crisis thus far have been the right wing. Most evidently the far right, which of course should worry everyone here. Just a few examples of this. In Sweden, Sweden, you kind of think of it as being something democratic, welfare state, egalitarian. Well, the Swedish fascists are now the third largest party in the Swedish parliament. In France, the Front National, the National Front, now under Marine Le Pen, daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen, is polling third in the race for France's 2012 election, and about 15-20% of the vote. In Hungary, a fascist party by the name of Jobbik is now running third in the polls with 17% support. In Holland, the far-right party led by Geert Wilders is in a three-way coalition government. In Finland, an election happened, I think, earlier this week. The so-called True Finns Party has just quadrupled its vote from 5% to 20% by mobilising an anti-immigrant and anti-EU bailout sentiment. So you can kind of see what they're getting at there. They're trying to mobilise workers and, the lower middle class by saying, fuck these Greeks, fuck these Italians, fuck these Irish, why should we bail them out? And then tying that to kind of down with the Muslims, down with the immigrants and so forth, kind of a petty nationalist kind of far-right kind of ideology. Now, it's not just the far-right being the beneficiaries, although you have to say they've been the main beneficiaries at the moment. Well, another way of putting it is to say that the more mainstream conservative parties, seeing a portion of their vote being sucked towards the far-right, have responded by moving right for themselves. And so you've seen in France, Sarkozy, with his anti-Burqa legislation, all part and parcel of Muslim bashing, a campaign underway for some years now. In Germany, Angela Merkel is saying that multiculturalism in Germany has failed and the job of migrants basically is to assimilate and speak German. In Italy, Berlusconi has been kicking the migrant can as well, slamming immigrants, deporting them, and also attacking the Roma people. In Britain, David Cameron, just earlier this week or late last week, made an anti-immigration, an immigrant-bashing speech that shook even some Tories for its reversal of their kind of big society, kind of we care, we're not like Margaret Thatcher really, kind of policy. Well, kind of David Cameron is part of, not coincidentally, at the very same time forcing through big cuts, also trying to target immigrants, and Muslims in particular, for being the cause of people's woes. So you have to say that even though the capitalist system may have proven to be utterly bankrupt, both literally and metaphorically, the left at present is far too small to offer a serious alternative on the one hand the reformist trade union bureaucracy and the reformist parties that want to divert the struggle towards an electoral outcome, and on the other hand, too small to really seriously challenge the rise of the far right. Or putting it another way, insofar as the centre ground has been squeezed under the impact of the economic crisis, the main beneficiaries of that have been the far right rather than the far left, which of course is a very worrying trend. Nonetheless, having said that though, the very fact that a whole series of preconceived ideas about the fact that you can depend on governments, that the welfare state is there as a safety net, that people have got basic job security and their kids' fortunes will be better than their own, all the sort of things that underpin liberal democracies, they're all being either trashed or severely questioned now. And it's that kind of political volatility that does present opportunities for the far left. An argument the Socialist Alternative made 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, when the economic crisis first struck, which is this crisis was going to be a persistent crisis, it wasn't a flash in the pan, that the economic crisis would present a whole new political landscape has been proven to be correct. In a sense, the whole, you know, political map of Europe and North America and generally the world system has been redrawn by this economic crisis. The outlook for the working class in coming years, as far as governments are concerned, the capitalists are concerned, is pretty bleak. It's unlikely that the world economy will keep recovering or keep kind of growing exponentially by to any degree. Already, if you have a look at that, that kind of recovery I showed you in that very first slide, you see it goes like that and kind of begins to go like that. So we're not talking about sustained recovery in any meaningful sense. So the ruling class is using this crisis to carry out what they see as being a once in a generation, or perhaps more accurately, once in every 3 generations opportunity to smash the welfare state that they were forced to pay for a period of time. Because despite all the Thatcherism, the Reaganomics, and all the cuts that took place in the 80s and 90s, actually welfare spending as a proportion of GDP rose across most major economies in that period. Now they're determined to use the crisis to drive that spending back down again. For the capitalist class at the moment, providing you're not a member of the government in Greece or Ireland, there is no immediate crisis in the sense that the profits are now back up again, the CEO payouts are very high, but nonetheless the crisis underpinning it all has not gone away. And most importantly, they're facing waves of resistance. Even though this hasn't been expressed electorally yet, it is, in most cases, it is the case that the streets of Europe and even in the case of Wisconsin, the United States, have been filled with angry protesters disgusted at what their governments are doing. Now, so far, this resistance has been limited because of the kind of throttling and choking activities of the reformist parties and the trade union leaders. Nonetheless, the potential is there for these struggles to break through, just as we saw in the Arab world. Now, we're not always aware of this ourselves. If you can kind of listen to my speech and talk about, you know, the threat of the far right, you know, the reformist leaders, how they hold back the struggle, you know, trade union leaders agree with half the program of the government, they're not prepared to lead a serious fight, we think, oh, bloody hell, you know, everything's pretty dreadful. But our rulers certainly understand the potential for resistance, even if it's not happening on the streets this very moment. If you read the reports of people like the IMF and the European Union and so forth, all the time you see reference to taking into account political moods. The IMF have got a lovely phrase, only an economist could have invented this one. They talk about their concern about what they call fiscal policy implementation shocks. Now, what the fuck? A fiscal policy implementation shock is basically a general strike. Why didn't Rosa Luxemburg think about that as a title for her pamphlet, not the mass strike, the fiscal policy implementation shock? Now, the fiscal policy implementation shock is basically saying, look, we don't know how long the working class of Europe and North America are going to put up with shit. And we're worried that there's going to be a big wave of revolt that will stop us implementing what we want to do. And their solution is basically ram things through as quickly as they can and hope they can do it rather like, you know, Colin Powell and, what's his name, Rumsfeld and all the rest of them did with Baghdad in 2003, and hit the working class before they have a chance to get up on their feet. So, nonetheless, they're trying to do it, but as the evidence in places like Greece and Ireland and so forth have shown, they haven't always been successful. They face what they call, more directly, social explosions. So their nightmare is our greatest hope. The Arab world basically shows the way. And I had a whole section of my talk talking about inspiration, the Arab Revolution to Greece and so forth in Wisconsin. I had to chop it out. But I think you'd have to say that when you look at the whole revolution tradition, Lenin, for example, 100 years ago, actually has had the forecast that even though many Marxists thought that Russia was a backward shithole, where nothing much would happen, and that, you know, future lay in Germany, and you know, those, you know, doughty proletarian strongholds of Berlin, not backward kind of provinces of Moscow and St. Petersburg, he actually said, in fact, precisely the weak point of the world capitalist system, Russia, actually had the potential to spark off a revolution in the more advanced countries in Western Europe. And so it is the case that we can only hope that the revolutions in the Arab world, if you like, a weak point in world imperialism, are capable of sparking off a new wave of resistance and learning all the lessons about the importance of mass occupations, don't give up, persist until you win, keep the revolutionary process rolling forward, that those kind of lessons can begin to percolate and permeate through working class consciousness in Europe and North America and give them lessons that they can see and enter their regimes as well.